Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Let's get the event started. So I'm really delighted to be here today. I have to read this out, so I'll be instructed. This is an event called Industrial Strategy for the Green Economy. Hosted by LSE Environment Week. We do this every year, and this is one of the highlights of the Environment Week. I'm John Van Rienen. I'm the Ronald Coase Chair of Economics here at the LSE. And before we get started, there's a few housekeeping items that I need to cover. So, first of all, this event is part of LSE Environment Week. It has a mixture of academic seminars, masterclasses, panels, and public events. The event is being live streamed, and we're also recording today's session, so it's going to be made available as a podcast and video subject to no technical difficulties, which for the LSE is often a big ask, but hopefully there will be no technical difficulties. We have designated some time towards the end of the panel discussion to answer questions from our audience, both in person and those who are connected remotely. So keep your questions ready for the end. And those of you who are joining us online can type in their questions in the Q&A box, and my colleagues will make sure to pass them on to me. So please make sure to include your full name and organisational affiliation. And if you're contributing to the conversation online, please use the hashtag LSEEvents. And for those in the room, can I please ask you to put your phones on silent to avoid disrupting the event, and I'm going to do that to myself at the same time. Thank you. Okay, so, I'm really delighted to be chairing this evening's event. The subject is going to be one of the, most important subjects, I think, when it comes to thinking about climate change, which is how the climate change relates to trade and trade policies. They're becoming increasingly interwoven in many dimensions. So we often see a lot of subsidies for green industries around the world, most obviously in China, which has provoked some reaction to that with tariffs from the US and the European Union over things like solar panels and electric vehicles. We've seen a lot of action in terms of different policies towards climate, such as the European Union's emission trading system. That's increasingly set a higher carbon price. Recently, there has been some reaction to the worries that high carbon price is causing pain to European industries, and those industries are relocating overseas, and we're importing more of the carbon intensive goods from overseas. So we'll be talking a lot about so-called the carbon border adjustment mechanism, which is, as will be explained by our first speaker, Luis Garicano, a way of trying to mitigate some of those problems. That in itself has caused lots of issues of different trade and trade policy. We also know that trade is a good way to actually import cheap goods from around the world, which can be good for reducing the cost of the climate transition. So I want you to join me in welcoming our distinguished panellists. We have our own Luis Garicano, who's a school professor here from the LSE School of Public Policy, my friend and co-author. We have Maya Rojas, who is the Minister for the Environment in Chile since 2022. She's also a physicist and holds a doctorate in atmospheric physics from the University of Oxford. And last but not least, we have Catherine Wolfram, who is the William F. Pound Professor of Energy Economics and the Professor of Applied Economics at the MIT Sloan Management, where I used to work, so I'm very happy but also envious of her working in such a great place. So our event's going to run for a total of 90 minutes. We've changed the order a little bit, so Luis is going to give us the first intervention, which is going to be a European angle from his time in the European Parliament when the CBAM was introduced. Next, we're going to have Minister Rojas, who's going to give us a Chilean perspective on environmental policy and trade. And finally, Catherine is going to speak, who's going to present a US perspective on green industrial policies of the Biden administration. So each speaker is going to have 10 minutes, then we'll have a moderated Q&A discussion. So without that, I think I'm going to hand over to Luis. So big clap. Thank you to all our...
Thanks very, very much. If I can have my slides up. Oh, there. Excellent. So I'm going to tell you about the corporate bonus adjustment mechanism. I participated in the legislative process. I was helping put it down, make it happen. And I'm going to give you the rationale for it. How does it influence trade? Why did we want to do it? What is the objective? And how do we hope it's going to change the planet? The CBAM, let me just use the... It's a carbon border adjustment mechanism. I'm going to describe it in a second. But let me just tell you that suddenly there was a lot of political consensus in Europe for it. Now, when we started in the parliament, basically everybody wanted it. Why did they want it? In Europe, we have a system which is called emission trading system. If you want to pollute, you have to buy the permit to pollute. Okay? So these permits get bought and sold, and as I'll show you later, each time there are less and less permits. That means that European firms are at a disadvantage because they have to pay for polluting, and somebody could just take a car plant from Europe to Morocco and have this plant export the cars and not buy the permits. So the political logic was strong because there was a climate logic. People say, hey, great, it's good for the planet, as I'll show you. Industrial policy was good. Hey, we protect domestic jobs. And so labor firms liked it. So it passed, and now it's in place. Now I'm going to tell you what it is. I'm going to tell you how it works. Basically, the Germans liked it because they wanted to expand the emission trading scheme, the cap and trade. The French wanted this kind of measure as a competitiveness measure, and it's now in place. So just to tell you where we are as a frame, and then I'll go into the matter. We are in the transition. In October, it started. Nobody has to pay. Foreigners. Okay, so what does the CBAM do? I missed telling you. The foreigners also now have to buy these permits. That's what it means. Okay, if you take your car factory to Morocco, you're also going to have to buy the permit to pollute. You can't pollute for free. That's what is going to happen. Okay? And I'm going to explain. So right now, in a phase where nobody has to pay, there's just a reporting obligation. They have to measure their emissions and they have to say how much they emit. Then we're going to review it. But it's going to be fully operational on July 26. What does January 26? What does it mean that it's fully operational? It means that firms are going to have to buy a permit if they want to export into Europe, equivalent to what they would have had to buy if they were polluting the same amount and they were in Europe. They have to pay for polluting. Now, I'm going to tell you how we designed it and why we designed it the way we did, how we saw these design choices, understand the compromise, and talk a bit about the trade dimension. So, first of all, let me give you the context of the world. So, basically, Europe has implemented the carbon price initiative that includes the UK, and that means you gotta pay for polluting. You have to buy permits if you want to. Now, look at the big part of the world that doesn't have a system of paying in any way for polluting. So the idea that, hey, polluting you're incurring a cost, you're costing a cost to the climate, so you should pay for it, is not something that exists in much of the world. And the greenhouse emissions are increasing since 1990 by 40%. And this is a graph from a paper by Catherine Wolfram, who's sitting there, which shows you. So I told her that I was going to steal some of her graphs, not from her presentation, from her paper, but I don't know if you have this one, which shows you that the carbon price. So this tells you what's the carbon price and coverage per jurisdiction, and you see what's the share of emissions subject to carbon price. So you see two interesting things here. These are European countries. You see that Europe, the carbon price is higher, and you see that more emissions are covered. Yes, China has a carbon price, but China has a carbon price which is very, very, very low, so it doesn't really matter to them. Okay, so that's the starting point. Now, it's interesting to think, oh, wow, how did Europe manage to put this carbon price when the U.S., look, the U.S. doesn't have a carbon price except in a few very narrow situations. How did Europe manage? This politics is a weird thing, and this was politics. Europe couldn't pass a tax on carbon, couldn't pass a broad European-wide tax on gasoline or things like that. So what it did was it said, oh, we're not going to do a tax, we're going to do a system that is going to allow people to trade permits. And that was politics. It wasn't really just the very kind of smart thing that Europe did. It was the only thing that was feasible. Although it is smart and it's the one that economists like. So it's a huge cap and trade system that Europe has. So 11,000 heavy energy using installations have, if they want to emit, they have to pay for it. Now, you set a cap on the total amount of greenhouse, and you little by little decrease that cap. Okay? So you set this cap, you buy or sell an allowance, the permit to pollute, and little by little it gets reduced and the price goes up, and you say, oh, this is very expensive, I prefer not to pay for this, but to change my plant to make it less polluting, etc., etc. That's the idea. Okay? The cap decreases over time. You see here how it decreases. Okay? There's little by little, Europe is going to have less emissions that are traded, from 220 to 190 gigatons in this period. And we have seen an increase in carbon prices over that period from almost zero to around $63 today. This is from yesterday's graph. Also from Catherine, the problem is in energy-intensive sectors, you're going to have what is called leakage. What does it mean, leakage? What I explained you about Morocco. Take a plant to Morocco or to the US, produce your whatever polluting thing you have, and then export it, and you're home free. So that's a bad thing. This leakage problem means that Europe has been reducing its emissions, but it has been increasing how many emissions are embedded in the product it buys. Okay, so we produce less, but we buy a car that has emitted a lot when it was manufactured in Mexico. Okay, that's the problem. There is little systematic evidence of this leakage. Everybody understands what the leakage is. The leakage is, I don't pollute here, but the planet is as dirty because I pollute somewhere else, and then it goes to the planet, and then I export the car. Okay, so there's little systematic evidence, but we know the carbon price is going down, and we know the free allowances are going to go away. I'm not going to tell you about free allowances because that's going to be, I think it's going to be taking me too much time. Basically, if you're very efficient, you don't have to pay. They give you some allowances for free. Okay? So basically, the price starts to hit you once you are over a certain benchmark value. Okay? So we wanted to design a CBAM that was not a protectionist measure. Okay? Yes, it's also going to avoid competitiveness. We want to make sure that it's WTO compatible, that trade doesn't get negatively affected. But our effort was really about environment, about protecting the environment. And I'm going to tell you how we can do that. So the idea is, look, all very good. You don't want to have a carbon price. Mr. Turkey, for example, you're Turkey, you're a country that doesn't have this. And you want to kind of dump your product, let's say. All very good. But now you're going to have to pay anyway. So we are trying to invite you to introduce a carbon price so that you don't have to give us this money. Okay, that's the idea. So the primary aim is environmental. How is it going to work? So basically, the basic idea of CBAM is this. I anticipated a little bit before. So you are an exporter of steel products to Europe. You haven't paid for polluting when you were producing all your steel. Sorry, we're going to charge you, and I will tell you exactly, the same as if you had produced the price in Europe. So it mirrors the price, so it's not discriminating. We're not charging people what our producers don't have to pay. It must avoid that they pay twice. So if they have their own CBAM, if they have their own ETS, if Turkey has a carbon tax or introduces some price of carbon, they can discount it. They don't need to pay us for that. And it allows you to say, oh, I'm actually a very clean plant. Look, here is my certificate. So I don't have to buy as many permits. So it should allow importers to demonstrate how much carbon they need. These were three principles that we put from the standard legislation. This has happened. These principles are in the final legislation. We decided to do it based on ETS and not based on taxes, particularly because we didn't want WTO to say you're trying to do protectionist measures. So the timing was basically as the free allowances, which is permits for free to pollute, are going away, we are introducing the ETS at the same time. That's the timing that was agreed in the final legislation. What products have to be covered by CBAM? Which exporters into Europe have to go around and buy permits? You would think, well, you should start small and then grow it because it's complicated. Somebody from Turkey or China or whatever is going to have to buy a permit, certify their emissions, show how much they are polluting, buy permits. That sounds very complicated. It's true. Start small is good. But there is a risk, which is if I tell you this product, if I tell you you cannot do the bottles of glass because that's included, then you're going to make them in plastic. So there is a lot of risks of substitution or of distorting where you produce. So my preference when we were discussing the legislation in Parliament was we wanted the final legislation to be broad, but the final compromise only included six things: cement, iron, steel, aluminum, fertilizer, electricity, and hydrogen. Now, these are very highly polluting things, okay? These are among the most highly polluting. Now, this is going to be expanded into other sectors starting in a couple of years, but there's new legislation has to be included. So we are kind of saying coal, petroleum products, other things have to be included. What is the scope one and scope two? The basic idea is this. Not only the aluminum is covered, but also the cars made from aluminum. So the scope of the legislation is what is in orange. Every product that is with these six products, so the emissions generated by producing cement or steel, plus the emissions produced by the electricity produced in generating the steel, plus the emissions produced with input materials that are in the C1 scope. So if I make a car, it's from aluminum, those emissions as well. What is not included is the transport downstream and the raw materials that go into transportation and distribution, etc. So that's two. So what is the aim? It's an environmental aim. You're going to pay what Europeans pay. Second, what is the scope? Six of the products covered by the emission trading scheme in Europe, and the other ones eventually. How do you assess it? This is very hard, right? You all must be thinking, my goodness, how are you going to figure out if a Chinese plant is using clean energy or dirty energy? How much are they polluting? What a mess, okay? So how are we going to do that? So basically, you have to define the process. I'm not going to go over that. And you have to submit some information on how much emitted emissions are there. And what you're going to do is basically the following. You can measure it. You have a detector and you measure it. Or you use a calculation method. I know how much aluminum takes. I know how much aluminum is there in a car. I know how much pollution goes into making aluminum. Oops, that's how much permits you have to buy. Okay. Now, this can be done in two ways that I'm not going to bore you with because I'm almost out. One very important thing, when you count the electricity, how do I know if you used clean electricity or dirty electricity? That seems very hard because you can very easily say, oh, I actually produced this steel. The Chinese can say the steel that we sent to Europe is all produced with these beautiful wind turbines. How do I know? Okay. So in order to avoid that, if you want to say that this electricity is clean, you have to have it plugged to those windmills. Or you have to at least, you can't just say that windmill, it's actually the one producing this. Okay? You try to avoid the shuffling. Now, trade, WTO compatibility. Our view is that this is completely compatible with world trade for two reasons that I told you. One, you're not discriminating, and the minister is going to probably disagree, and I will be happy to hear her. So that's what makes this interesting, okay? She comes after me, not the other way around. So maybe that's why they asked me to go first. I'm not discriminating between imported and domestic goods. If you are coming with your steel, you are having to buy the same permits as if I had made steel myself. So I'm not being protectionist, okay? Second, I'm not discriminating between countries. Any country that has the same pollution is going to have their producers pay the same. It's not, I mean, one thing that the World Trade Organization, the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, prohibits is to give one country better deals than the others. Well, we're not doing that. If you have the same carbon intensity, you're going to pay the same. So besides, we think that the GATT says, so I say this to your point about, well, GATT, the WTO doesn't get into it. WTO, the GATT says, look, nothing in the agreement shall prevent the adoption of measures to protect human, animal, plant life, or to conserve exhaustible natural resources. So we think even if those two reasons didn't work, we have a get-out-of-jail-free card here. So our objective is to collect zero money. We don't want to collect any money. We want people to say, hey, I'm Turkey. I'm South Korea. I hate to pay the Europeans for exporting steel. I much rather pay myself. I introduce a carbon pricing method. I prove to the Europeans, hey, look, I already paid for the carbon, and they're excluded from CBAM. This happened in Turkey. EU's looming carbon tax nudged Turkey towards Paris Climate Accord, and what it says, and this is what happens in South Korea. South Korea intends to open negotiation with the EU on its proposal for border trade. The goal is to accept Korean exports. The Korean emission trading scheme covers the range. Same story, okay? They are saying, look, we have the same thing. We don't have to pay. That's what we want. Now, Catherine and her co-author Kim have this slide without filling in the blanks. I fill up the blanks. Probably because they were in government, we want to save. But we have big problem, and that's something Catherine will talk a lot about, I think, between the US and Europe for the following reason. There are two ways to fight climate. I can say, if you pollute, you're going to pay. Or I can say, if you don't pollute, I'm going to give you a present. Okay? That's reducing your cost of being nice. And I am imposing you a cost for being nasty. Now, both of them are going to give you a reduction in you all agree, right? Your parents could say, you know, if you're bad, you're going to get punished. Or they could say, if you're good, I give you £100. Both will give you the same outcome. Problem is, these firms are competing. The one who got the extra present from the US, which is a very special big present in the form of the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of money for being clean, has lower cost than the ones in Europe who are like, oh, you know, you have to pay for polluting. So that's a problem into the future that we will want to discuss today. The second problem I want to mention, and I finish here, is the trade implementation risk. The risk is the non-tariff barrier. One thing we are afraid of is you are somebody in one of these African countries that are in red. For example, Egypt. So you are actually, there's a lot of stuff that you export to Europe that is actually covered by CBAM. That's what this graph says. And you have to do paperwork, you have to justify your emissions, etc. And you're not a very rich country. And so maybe you don't have auditors, you don't have consultants, and so you stop producing. Not because of the price you have to pay, but because of the paper. Now, you don't really have to do the paper because you can just go for the standard method. I have a car. Car has so many tons of steel. This is the electricity content of steel, end of the story, and the carbon content of steel, end of the story. So we think it shouldn't be the case, but you will hear this country say it is the case. Okay. So my view on this, I finish here, my view on this is this is a good initiative by Europe that has the potential, as more countries introduce carbon pricing, to spread internationally the carbon compliance, because people want to export to Europe and they don't want to give us the money for the export, so they want to do it themselves. And that is, I think, well designed in terms of economic logic by having the right aim, a reasonable scope that will be expanded, a reasonable entry rate, and a reasonable way to measure that I haven't explained to you, but I am happy to explain to you if you ask me any question. Thank you. Don't dump too much on the Europeans.
Good afternoon, good evening, everyone. I don't have any slides, but I still prefer to stay here to be sure that I can get my ideas. Okay, so now the first thing I will say is that, and if some of you were in the session today in the afternoon, I think there are still many questions about these new schemes that are, I would call it other ways of tackling, addressing a problem that we all have, and is that although we all signed the Paris Agreement about 10 years ago, emissions are not going down. And in that sense, it is of course important to think about innovative solutions and border adjustment mechanisms might be one of them. There are many questions still, and our foreign ministry is still looking at them. So I will let them, once they have decided their conclusion, to tell them. But what I will do then, from the perspective of our environment minister, tell you a little bit what Chile is doing and how I believe that whatever the outcome of this type of policy in the World Trade Organization will be, that the country is well positioned with doing the job of actually reducing our emissions and reducing the carbon intensity of the products that we are exporting. And for that, let me just very briefly tell you that Chile is a very long and narrow country, has a very small economy, And so it is a very open economy. We have over 20 free trade agreements. And environmental regulation has, in many sense, been driven by those agreements. Most of those agreements have some chapter on environment. And back in 2005-2010, Chile became part of the OECD, and that, of course, was a very important push to put our environmental regulation to the same standard as the rest of the OECD countries. Back in those days as well, I was mentioning a bit as a curiosity, but probably being Minister of Energy was the worst nightmare that could have been the worst job that you could have in Chile, because Chile does not have fossil fuels. And so the problem of energy security was a very serious one, because you're exposed and the volatility of the prices, or if you buy gas to some neighbors and that neighbor decides to cut the gas, then you are in deep trouble. So energy security was a main motivation, I would say, to the evolution and development of renewable, so-called non-conventional renewable energy, solar, wind, and others. So I would say that it started not because of an environmental motivation, but really a general security one. And Chile, although it's not an island, it does a bit work like an island, because we have very high mountains on the one side and a big ocean on the other side. So the geographic barriers are important. So that's how the story with the energy, our energy transition started. And then, of course, climate change became a much more important topic, and we were suffering as well many of the consequences already that we were already feeling in the country. So Chile signed the Paris Agreement, and from then on we have, since now 2022, a climate change law. A climate change law that is a whole of government, whole of economy, all of greenhouse gas climate change law, and that says that Chile will be carbon neutral at the latest by 2050, but also resilient to the negative effects of climate change. So it has mitigation and adaptation. We address the causes and the consequences of climate change. And I'm going to, because we're talking here about CO2 emissions and about mitigation, in the mitigation part we have a carbon budget, in a sectorial carbon budget, so each sector has to green its own emissions. So, for example, when I see that some of the products that will soon come into CBAM, if there will be copper, well, we will have a copper that we can say it's not using, you know, diesel or another types of dirty energy to produce our tons of copper. That is, it's going to be a result of our law. And we have a carbon tax as well that you also saw in one of the graphs. It is unfortunately still very, very small. But there was an interesting aspect, I think, in our tax, is that it covers not only CO2, but it covers also local pollution, because actually the main environmental problem that we have in Chile is local pollution, air quality problems. So with this tax you can reduce or you can also compensate locally you're not allowed to you can reforest or reduce the production of goods via polluting industry. And so we address not only the global problem but also the local one, which I think it's very important for us, because it will bring a direct benefit to our people through health benefits and etc. Because we have to remind ourselves as well that, of course, climate change is a global issue, but and the benefits are felt globally, but locally it is also important to advance in a country that still has many development challenges. So the law includes, for example, also a social cost of carbon that we have just increased, and hence that will allow that at least public investment that does include that cost of carbon, so it's only for our public investment, and therefore also clean our own economy for other social and economic and environmental benefits. And I guess so the last thing that I would like to say is that our law also comes with an important monitoring, reporting, and verification system. And in that sense, for example, one of the important issues of actually being able to apply the CBAM is that the data is available, that you can actually say how much carbon is put in this product that I'm going to sell or buy. And that should be readily available through the implementation of the law in Chile. So with that, a bit of a flavor of how addressing climate change, at least on the mitigation part, is working in Chile and how ready we are to show with important level of transparency that we are actually reducing our emissions. I believe that whatever the outcome of these measures about border adjustment mechanism or other mechanism that will or that might be available in the near future, we should be ready to do that, and we do that because we think that not only it is important that every country helps in the challenge of addressing climate change, but because it also gives a very important sustainable development future for our own country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. And the final speaker is Catherine Wolfram.
Thank you so much. So while they're pulling up my slides, as John said, I'm an economist, and the economics of climate change are actually very simple, but they're very discouraging. Let me explain. There are a number of names. Do I have to do something?
I just joke. If you just start pressing, it's going to happen.
Ah, brilliant.
You have. Do I still be the keeper?
I can just do now.
No, there's, look here.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so why do I say they're very simple but very discouraging? There are a number of names that economists give to this problem. You can call it a public good problem, a free rider problem, principle, or the prisoner's dilemma. But think about it from the perspective of an individual country. To tackle climate change, you either have to spend a lot of money, like the US is doing, or you have to do the emissions trading system, the carbon price, like the Europeans are doing. That involves potentially driving some of the auto manufacturers to Morocco. It might involve raising gasoline prices for farmers. It's just politically and economically disruptive. So every country is facing this question, do I do something to address climate change, or do I kind of sit back and hope that the rest of the world's in? And the overriding choice is to sit back and hope that the rest of the world knows about it. Because basically what's good for a country individually is not what's good for the collective, for the globe. It's a very classic economics problem. The incentives are very straightforward. CBAM is something that flips the switch on that, that reverses the incentives. So I have been studying the economics of climate for almost 20 years, and I am super excited about CBAM in a way that I haven't been in previous. Because what CBAM does is say, okay, if you want to sit back and do nothing about climate change, then if you want to export your goods around the world, you're going to have to pay a price. You're going to have to pay the border adjustment. And so especially for very export-oriented countries, this is a big deterrent from sitting back. Also, as Luis explained, if you are a country, say Turkey, if you are an exporting country to the European Union, the way they've designed the CBAM is you get credited, your exporters get credited for whatever price they've paid domestically. So I am now with the IGC team in Mozambique studying the Mozambican example. Mozambique's a huge exporter of aluminum, and a lot of their aluminum goes to the European Union. Mozambique's aluminum exports are like 17% of their total export. It's a huge industry in Mozambique. And so Mozambique, the aluminum exporting firm, either has to pay the tax, the border adjustment, and write a check to Brussels. But if Mozambique, the government, puts on a carbon tax, then its exporting company gets credited for the Mozambique carbon tax that it's paid. And then Mozambique gets to keep the carbon tax. So its incentives are clearly to adopt a carbon price here. So, Luis got into the descriptions of leakage, and we can talk about it in the Q&A. There are definitely some detractors or some opponents of CBAM, but I want to paint the kind of layout, the positive story. So this is from a forthcoming policy brief that I have with several colleagues. And what it's plotting is in like Google News, we scraped a bunch of news stories, and we're looking at countries that did not have carbon prices. So the EU isn't here, Chile probably isn't here, shouldn't be here, and are not the US. And this is, the red line is the number of times that the word carbon price or cap and trade, which is like the ETS system, have come up in that in those countries. And so you see that before CBAM was introduced, it was kind of hovering around 500 times per month. But after CBAM, it's like 2,000 or 2,500. And so literally CBAM is starting a global conversation about carbon pricing. Lots and lots of news reports, these are news reports in like Taiwan and China and Pakistan, they're talking about carbon pricing. That's a good thing. The other thing that you see is, you know, carbon pricing is good. Economists like it. It forces companies to think about the costs of their emissions. That's why we want them to have carbon prices. But really, the ultimate goal is to decarbonize, right? Is to have clean energy, green steel. So here we're doing a similar thing. We're looking at these Google News stories in the countries that don't have carbon prices and aren't the U.S. And again, you see after CBAM, there's a huge increase in the number of times you see the words decarbonization, clean energy, the green line down there. You know, it's actually going up by a lot, even though it's kind of low. That's green steel. People are now talking about how to make steel with green processes or with processes that don't emit a lot of CO2. So this is why I'm just thrilled about CBAM, because it's kind of exporting to the rest of the world this conversation about carbon pricing. And we've also, this is in the policy brief, but not in the slide deck, we've also looked at basically updating Luis's slides, or where he had the map with all the countries that had adopted carbon pricing. So that map was from 2023. It should be pretty up to date. In fact, it's not. There's just been a ton of progress in countries actually adopting carbon prices, like Turkey. If you look at the current version of that graph, it has Brazil and India kind of shaded a little bit lighter because they are contemplating carbon pricing if have not yet adopted carbon pricing. In fact, if you look at it and look at all of the G20 countries, that's 80% of the world economy, all but three G20 countries have either adopted a carbon price or are talking about it in the cases of India and Brazil. The three countries that haven't are the US, Saudi Arabia, and Russia. Thank you. So, okay, part of my effort in putting out this policy brief is trying to get across to US government decision makers, the US is an outlier here, people. We are not, like the rest of the world is talking about carbon pricing. Here's what's happening in terms of news mentions of the same terms in the US. It's like straight. If anything, you can see that after we passed the Inflation Reduction Act, the discussions about carbon pricing started going down. So that's discouraging. I think if the US were to adopt a carbon price, we could make even more progress with this. Okay, so let me make three points, and hopefully more discussion of this will come up in the Q&A. I phrase them here as questions, and the answer to all these questions is no. Maybe I was feeling a little negative when I wrote this slide, but okay. So one of the critiques of CBAM is that it's bad for the global south. There have been people that call, that describe CBAM as an example of regulatory colonialism. This is the EU saying, we have a carbon price, therefore we're going to impose a carbon price on the domestic, on the global south. We think everyone should do the same thing. What we're finding in our research with Mozambique is that the CBAM is not unambiguously bad for low and middle income countries. Our results are preliminary, but we think that the CBAM might be, in fact, good for Mozambique's aluminum export. Why, you might ask, like it's being asked to pay this cost to pay for carbon emissions when it hadn't been asked to pay for that before. But it's in a market where everyone else is also being asked to pay for their carbon emission. And Mozambique's aluminum producer is pretty clean. And so the price for aluminum, the green premium, you might think of it, is going to go up, we think, by more than the Mozambique's aluminum exporters costs. So that could be good for Mozambique. You know, maybe it starts expanding the way it produces aluminum. I was at a panel by a gentleman from an NGO based in Nairobi, and he used this description of what he thought might come about with policies like CBAM, policies that basically rewarded clean production and penalized dirty production. He said, before we started thinking about climate change in Europe, energy basically flowed from the east to the west. There were coal mines in Poland, and they were shipping coal to West Germany, where they were producing autos. In the future, he envisions energy flowing from the south, that Africa has all this potential, have hydroelectric power, to have solar power, huge, huge solar radiation potential. And so Africa can become kind of this engine of green production, of clean production, export both the energy, maybe, you know, use that energy to export goods to Europe. So I can't sugarcoat it. I think there are some places, maybe China, that will be at least in the short run worse off with something like CBAM, but I think it's not unambiguously bad for the global south. So is the U.S. a lost cause on carbon pricing? You saw that picture with us not talking about it anymore. I think there are three reasons for hope that the U.S. could potentially find its way to a carbon price. And the first is CBAM. Like, the U.S. is eventually, I know we can be kind of insular, but the U.S. is going to figure out that there are a lot of other countries that are talking about carbon pricing. If Canada, the U.S. has a lot of trade with Canada. If Canada were to put on a border adjustment, that would really get the U.S.'s attention. Even failing that, I think, you know, seeing that the global conversation is moving this way will be useful. I think the other two things are more important, though. In the U.S., the fact that we have the Inflation Reduction Act now should make it easier to have a carbon price. The Inflation Reduction Act has all these subsidies for turning away from fossil fuels. Therefore, putting a price on the fossil fuels is less damaging, both politically and to the economy. The third reason I think that that carbon pricing might come up in the US is that in 2025, a big tax package that was passed in 2017, it's called the Trump Tax Cut and Jobs Act, that's gonna expire. Even though it was a Trump policy, there's bipartisan interest in extending most of those tax cuts, but that's a very expensive proposition. And right now, the U.S. is running very high deficits. And so if Congress is feeling fiscally responsible, they'll be looking for ways to pay for extending those tax cuts. Carbon pricing, unlike the Inflation Reduction Act, brings in revenue. So potentially that will get enough attention and will become part of the tax package that's negotiated during 25. I also think, you know, we can have a discussion about this. There are lots of details in the way that the EU is implementing the CBAM. That's not the only way to do it, but hopefully we will have a global conversation and kind of figure out the best way to implement CBAM. One thing in particular, if I were the president of the world, the way I would, people are chuckling, I know, maybe you wouldn't want a president of the world, no matter who it was, but imagine that you could write the policy that would be adopted. I think a fair policy would be one that rewarded low-income countries and maybe middle-income countries for a carbon price that was lower than the carbon price in the global north. So the IMF, for instance, has a policy or a paper that proposes a graduated carbon price. Low-income countries pay $25 a ton, high-income countries pay $75 a ton. So the CBAM could kind of reflect, okay, Mozambique, if you have a $25 a ton carbon price, you get exempt from the EU if they're at $75 a ton. So I think, you know, there are lots of different ways. What that does is it basically gives the low-income countries more carbon to emit. It puts a lower price on those carbon emissions than it does in higher-income countries. So I think there are lots of ways to think about tweaking the CBAM to make it more equitable and retain the positive properties that I talked about at the beginning. So, hope to have a great conversation about this. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
That was a great set of interventions, and I particularly like the fact there's a lot of optimism on the panel as well. I mean, you know, we as economists, we always get accused of being, you know, the dismal science. But I mean, I think this is an example where, at least in the CBAM world, this is an example where economics and action seems actually to be having, you know, quite a lot of positive. So my natural inclination is to pour cold water on everything at this point. But you know, I think it's worth maybe getting into some of these issues, because I think, as you all alluded to, the political problem is very strong. I mean, although, you know, Catherine, you're talking about the way people are talking more about carbon taxes. You know, when you look around the world, as Louise showed, even the places with a carbon tax are way lower than I think anybody thinks are necessary to get the kind of transition we want to. So, you know, with that in mind, let me turn first to the minister. So the story of Chile was very, you know, it's fascinating, because there has been this incredible growth of renewables, particularly around solar. And you mentioned that one of the motivations for that was the environmental motivation of the Paris Agreement, but you said the original motivation was actually energy security. So I wonder whether you could talk a bit more about that, because it's very relevant in terms of what's happening, thinking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, other geopolitical things. Do you think that, two related questions, one, if it wasn't for the energy security thing, would Chile have made the kind of transition it made? And are there kind of lessons for how to get the kind of politics right with the emphasis on energy security rather than just, you know, saving the world through climate change?
Well, I mean, it, as always in the real world, the solutions are more complicated, and the reasons are, there are many reasons of that. It's a mix of things. And definitely, yeah, when Argentina decided to cut the gas, and there was a very important drought, so the part of hydroelectric energy for 1 year was very, very low. That put a lot of pressure, of course, on the people that were in charge of the energy security, and that we could actually have the switch of the lights on. And then you see there is an environmental interest, because the fact that there was no water, we already understood that this had to do with climate variability and climate change. The political situation with the neighbors was more sort of like, yeah, political volatility. But also that in the case of Chile, many of the areas, like I guess in the rest of the world as well, where we produce dirty electricity, are locally very polluted as well. So we have these pockets of regions that we call sacrifice zones, where there's high level of pollution, not just because of coal-fired power plants, but other dirty sort of 20th century type of industry. So So I guess it's a mix of reasons that sort of put together, and then a political will. There was, in particular, I would say everyone agrees, one very important energy minister that sort of said, okay, I have this problem, I have this crisis, let's get something positive out of it. And then, and well, of course, solar started to, the prices to come down, etc., etc. So it was a mix of things and an important political will. And what is most important, I guess, and this is something that is also, I think, absolutely critical, is that it then became a sort of a state policy. We have had governments from left to right in the last 16 years. Not very extreme, but left to right, in this policy has stayed on, the energy and the climate change one. And that means that I can now grow from something that comes from, and we don't have to, we don't have the problem that the whole world is sort of looking at the November election in the U.S. to see if we will have the U.S. outside or inside the Paris Agreement, etc., etc., etc. So I think that is very, very important. And this was even without the law, and now with the law, I'm sure that it will be even easier to maintain and overcome challenges, because at each step there are, of course, challenges, because this is a big transformation.
Does anybody else want to come in on that? Or
yeah, I guess, so I laid out how hard it is to address climate change and the economics of that. I think there are a couple things going in our favor, and the minister has referred to both of them, but there are other reasons to do things that are good for climate change. One is it also happens to reduce local pollution, so that gives individual countries a reason to try to reduce fossil fuel consumption. And the second reason is energy security. I mean, as we saw with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there's kind of nothing like a petro-state that's invading its neighbor to make you realize just how difficult it is to live in a world where petro-states have that kind of political power or geopolitical power.
Good. I mean, let me relate to that question. So one of Chile has developed a strong solar power sector. A lot of the components for that, the solar panels, now come from China. So in terms of thinking about security and trade, is there a concern, I asked Lewis this question, is there a concern that if we're weaning ourselves off Russian gas, we're now weaned ourselves onto imports of Chinese solar panels and electrical vehicles? Does that matter if we just, well, are we happy to import all that from China, or is that another geopolitical risk that means we should be thinking of the risks for that type of security?
Yeah, that's a great, super complicated question. I don't know if, let me just make a parenthesis, I don't know if it was clear from the interventions at the start that John is right now in government and Catherine has been in the U.S., in the U.K. government, and Catherine has been in the U.S. government. And so all of us have this kind of dual view, right? We are able. I was in the European Parliament, and I was working on this legislation. I wrote the very first version of this in Parliament, in European Parliament. And we are kind of, we have been able to see the two sides of this, and to see the side of how it should be, and the side of how does the sausage get made, and how actually it is, right? And it's true that at least in Europe, this trade-off that John is setting up is affecting our voters in a very strong way. So let me be concrete about this. So Catherine said, "Oh, look, it's all going up. People are talking more about it," and it's true, and it's pretty good news. But I actually was in London Business School presenting a paper today, in which I was looking at narratives on climate. And what we see is that post-Ukraine, in continental Europe, among politicians in Europe, the narratives have flipped. So a lot of politicians. So basically, as you know, post-Ukraine, the electricity price increased by twice. So more than twice, okay? So the gas prices went through the roof. I mean, it was really a very big shock to voters. And politicians, many politicians started to kind of, it's very nice, this is the basic claim of the paper. In economics and in climate terms, nothing has changed because Ukraine invaded Russia and Russia invaded Ukraine. It's still the case that climate change is caused by CO2 and we want to decrease it. But suddenly this narrative became much less prominent in European politicians' speeches and kind of turned them around. And the China situation that John is raising is kind of similar. We have a very good source of solar panels, a very good source of batteries. It's very, very, very cheap. But it's so cheap that it has the Europeans terrified. Okay, the cars, if you go to Lima, does anybody from, well, Chile is probably the same. You guys import cars freely from China, right? There's no tariffs or big tariffs from China. I mean, in Lima, the cars are Chinese. Like every car which is less than two or three years old is bought in China, BYD and all these. I mean, the price is half. I mean, you ask somebody and they tell you, well, this is half the price as good, and it's electric, okay? So Europeans are worried about the gas prices from Russia, worried about the jobs going away if the cars come, and the solar panels come from China. And now, I mean, a bit contrary to what Catherine's hope was, there is all these European politicians talking about security, we don't want to import from China, jobs, we don't want to have these cars, Russia, the war, etc. There's a lot of politicians who are saying, wait, this climate thing is very good, but now we want to think of these other things. And the question of what do we do with cars, they're cheap, they're electric, they allow us to decarbonize, but they're going to kill our industry. The European industry won't exist in 5 years with the price differentials we have. It's a question that now European politicians are really, really, really struggling with. And I think my answer is, you are absolutely obliged to preserve the support of European voters, because if they are convinced that the political system doesn't care for their jobs, then you lose them, you lose the climate fight. So you're going to have to find some really uneasy compromise where, yes, Europe is going to have to put some tariffs on Chinese cars, but, for example, solar panels, I would say, to your question, John, solar panels is too late. We're not going to produce solar panels. They are so much cheaper from China. Let's just bring them on. So that's the compromise.
So, and this is a question for Catherine. So you talked a little bit about the Inflation Reduction Act, but America hasn't asked its question, and the answer to that question is things like the Inflation Act, you know, maybe up to $1 trillion now of subsidies to go towards electric vehicles, renewables, other form of kind of green industries, green technologies, but with strong local content requirements to pull activity back to the US. Do you want to talk a bit? What do you think about that? I mean, you were saying that, you know, let's have the carbon tax. That's going to be the solution, and maybe the US will have CBAM. But the US has gone a different route, which is to say, you know, politically, it's hard to get these hard carbon taxes. Hard to do regulations. Supreme Court just, you know, overruled the Obama change on lots of energy production. So the route that the Biden administration has gone down has been this kind of industrial policy subsidy route. Maybe take advantage from learning by doing externalities as they did in China. Do you think that was, are you out of government now? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Was that the only game in town? Yeah. What is your view?
As an academic.
even as an academic, I will say it was an unambiguously good thing. So I was, at the time that the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, or the initial thing that came out was that Senator Manchin, the crucial 50th vote from West Virginia, agreed to what became the Inflation Reduction Act. So when that came out, I got a text from my boss. I was in government. I was actually in the EU. It's one of those things where I remember literally where I was the moment that I heard. So the next day, I went to meetings with people in Brussels. It was like 3 a.m. in the U.S., everyone that we were meeting with in Brussels knew that this agreement had been reached and knew some of the details about it. It was a very, very important agreement. And I think it's worth kind of thinking about what the world would have done about climate change if the U.S., with a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic House, hadn't been able to do anything on climate change. And that's where we were 10 days before the Manchin-Schumer agreement came out. At that, 10 days before that, Manchin had walked out and said, nope, I just can't. I mean, he's from West Virginia. It's this heavy coal state. So I guess I think, like, whatever the U.S. did, the fact that they did something is huge. And it was a huge bill. It's going to spend a lot on subsidies for clean electricity, subsidies for clean manufacturing, subsidies for like nascent technologies, things like carbon capture and sequestration. Yes, it does have domestic content. You know, you get extra tax credits if you use domestic steel to make your windmills, and that has raised some ire in WTO and amongst our trade partners. We can get into the politics of that, but I think like at a high level, the world would be so discouraged if the U.S., the second largest emitter, hadn't been able to move forward on climate policy with a democratic trifecta.
So you're a supporter of it with caveats.
With caveats. I guess the other thing I'll say, though, is even as big a deal as it is, it's not getting us to our NDC. Even the most optimistic models suggest that we'll be like, you know, 45% below 2005 levels, and our goal is to be 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. So we need to do more. It's great, and we need to do more.
Should other countries also go down a similar route?
I'm not in the position to tell other countries what they should do. It's expensive. We're spending $1 trillion. I have some estimates that suggest we could get a similar level of reductions with a $12 per ton carbon tax. So it's, you know, economists get criticized for focusing on economic efficiency, but we're doing a lot of spending that isn't generating a huge amount of emission reductions.
Okay, so I think one more question, then we'll turn over to the audience. So one of the criticisms we heard today about CBAM was that the way it's actually been operationalized in the European Union, you touched on this, Lewis, has not been as effective as it could be. For example, only I think about 5% of goods are covered by CBAM. The bureaucratic burden it puts on many other countries in order to comply with it is extremely high. There's various proposals for reform. For example, looking at sort of, you know, the supply chain thing is still not done. So for example, you know, rather than having every other country in the world, you know, do audits of what they're doing, maybe just take what Europe is doing and look at the supply chains in Europe and the carbon content of Europe and just use that as an approximation. That would save incredible amounts of money and maybe make it easier to.
Yes, it would save money, but it would kind of be in some sense discriminatory, because you want to be able to tell the Mozambicans, look, if you were doing this, if we were us, we would charge you this, but we realize you're actually greener, apparently, Catherine's telling us, and you are able to prove this, you're going to pay less. So actually allowing countries to prove they do better, which is kind of requires a little bit more paperwork, you can always go with standard method. You can just say, I take the average, end of the story. Allowing countries to do this paperwork allows them also to do better. I think the prospects for reform are small. I think that the Green Deal was a massive project by the European Union during those years when I was in Parliament. We passed the expansion of the emission trading scheme to residential buildings and road transport. We passed the protection of the ecosystems. We passed the prohibition of internal combustion engines in Europe for 2035. So there was a lot of stuff. It was a big compromise to undo, even though the majorities in the Commission and the Parliament are different. I think it's not realistic. The question is whether there will be political will to continue pushing this and expand it. That remains to be seen. I mean, I think it's going to depend a lot on how complicated all these problems John is mentioning of implementation are going to be. But I think from my perspective, I mean, I was very, very happy to hear Catherine be so positive about it after going to Africa, because the question is really on the ground, how are people feeling? And here you have an example, but apparently I was really delighted to hear, because this is the kind of country you think, oops, how are they going to deal with this? And they're dealing well. So that's to me really, really, really good news. And of course, we have Chile, which, if you remember, my plan was in green. My talk was in green. It's not affected by any of the six products yet. And if we had Japan or India, we would have had a much more controversial discussion, because the Minister of Trade of Japan and India are really, really very vocal and very upset. So it would have been different. They would have said, like, oh, you Europeans are protectionists. I was happy.
That's why I was invited.
I was happy that Chile is like, oh, good.
Would you like to say that? I mean, just one quick question for the minister. I mean, you're a physicist, an academic by background, and not all of these debates are, you know, about the economics. Do you, have you, when, you know, in your role, have you found
what's been more persuasive, the economic kind of advisors or the more scientific, scientific approach?
You always need the evidence of the science, because that's what gives you some level of leverage over principles that you have to just follow. And that's actually quite embedded in the climate action of Chile. So it's not so strange that at the end of the day a climate scientist is a minister in Chile, because it kind of makes sense the way we have built our climate action, I would say. So that's the first thing. Then but what I have learned as well is that, of course, you know that, but as a minister, you understand it much more, that the economics is really the important part. You today in the afternoon were saying that this has to be about jobs, and yes, of course, it has to be about jobs. So Chile is, for example, trying to build an industry through the development of green hydrogen, and so there are some worries about the US now. On the other hand, Chile has lithium, and there we understand there is a big worry that the lithium that is produced in different parts of the world, if it only goes to China, and the Europeans are very interested, and the US as well, that lithium is sold out to different countries in a sort of that everyone has the right to buy it. So I think it is actually at an interesting point where there are in this global problem appearing many more levers and variables that make things a very complex problem, but interesting.
Great. Okay, well, let's open it up to the floor. Can you put your hands up, and I'll take a couple of questions. So lots of hands. Excellent. Chap in the front. I'll collect up a couple of questions, and if you'd like to say who you are and maybe who you're addressing the question to.
Thank you very much for your speeches. My name is Federico Rovida. I just came from Bocconi University, where I did my undergrad, and I'm happily attending LSE for my postgrads. So my question was... we mentioned cars, and we all very much know that the climate crisis is very urgent, although it doesn't seem on a daily basis. So what happened really recently with the European Commission is that, knowing that China is much more advanced on electric vehicles production, and of course it's more affordable, what it did is apply some extra duties to protect European manufacturers. And I understand that on one hand, because I know that applying a duty is much easier than the other option I'm going to put forward. It's much easier to do, it's quicker to do. But given the urgency of the crisis, given that we need to scale up electric vehicles and we need to have them more affordable for everybody, wouldn't it make more sense to give some subsidies to European manufacturers to help them scale up and improve their technology so that it would be more competitive with respect to their Chinese counterparts?
Okay. And thanks. Just we're gonna bring some other people in. That's a great question. So,
but can I close up the question?
I think you've asked the question.
No, the question in the end is, given this premise, do you think it's going to be possible, it's commendable, and hopefully will the European Commission take a stance on this in the next 5 years? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think there was some hands up again. Yes, lady there.
Hiya, Carson McEwen. I wanted to loop back to the point on regulatory colonialism raised by Catherine. And sort of regardless of the outcomes, which hopefully can be good, I'm sort of thinking that, from a climate justice perspective, the global south should also have a voice in the actual process of designing global governance mechanisms in this area. And I was wondering, especially, the EU obviously designs policy for the EU, but because of the nudging effect, there is that wider world implication. So are there ways for these global south representations to, for example, argue for the low middle income tweaks that Catherine would make if she were president of the world?
Okay, thank you. And one more, just the gentleman in the middle.
Oh, thank you. Hi, my name is Stanley. I'm from the United States. At least in the U.S., it appears that my generation is overwhelmingly politically disengaged and pessimistic on climate change. Moreover, even among those who are engaged, many support economically inefficient solutions. What activities or what actions, if any, would you recommend for us as not just scholars, but as constituents of democratic societies? Thank you.
Okay. So we've got electric vehicle tariffs versus subsidies, regulatory colonialism, and what should the US do? So for what should the US do, I'll have to turn to Catherine to begin with.
Yeah, that was a great question. I didn't hear it as much as what should the whole U.S. do, but what should the kind of Gen Z, younger generation do? I think that there is a role for lots of different forms of climate activism. I mean, you might think from what I said that I'm going to say you should convince every one of your cohort to be pro-carbon pricing and to be picketing about carbon pricing, but I don't know. As long as they're not like very, very critical of carbon pricing, I think it's fine to say we should be shutting down pipelines and kind of banning fossil fuels. I think it's okay to have kind of a large discussion about what the right thing to do is, because it's bringing attention to the problem, basically. I mean, whatever you can do to raise climate awareness and like get people to vote for the politicians that make the decisions, I think that's fine.
And regulatory colonialism from the yes, north to the south, including Chile, I guess.
Yes. Well, I guess in the case of Chile, we're kind of the good students in the classroom, and as I mentioned briefly, much of our regulation has come from the international openness of Chile. So the Ministry of Environment was created as a condition to become OECD country, right? So in that sense, I would say that's good news for me. Much has for me, someone who cares about the environment, much of the regulation and the fact that the way we produce goods in Chile does not have such an environmental impact comes from trade and those regulations as well, so that you cannot just produce or extract copper with enormous amounts of environmental impact. But being now not a low-income country but a middle-income country has its own challenges, and I think we should definitely be part of the conversation on how we find the right sort of tuning, as you mentioned, that, okay, if I have a carbon tax of that price, I should, how can help me to go further in my, and I like to say, climate resilient development path, right? I mean, because that is really what we want. We want, there are many challenges. Those challenges have to be thought as being part of, the climate is part of it, I always say. What we really, really need is not that the environment minister understands the problems of climate. I need all of the ministers, the whole of government, the whole of the society, to look through the climate change lenses, because this is really an existential threat to us all. So we want development, we want not any development. It has to be climate resilient, and that means it has to be clean, it has to be green, and it has to be resilient as well.
So Louis, you touched on this already, but what's the framework for thinking about tariffs versus subsidies when it comes to things like electric vehicles and other green goods in China elsewhere?
So I think we touched on it. I mean, a lot of these things come down to the political realities of what we are facing, right? The same way if you wanted to pass the Inflation Reduction Act, you had to get a vote of a senator from West Virginia. You needed to get coal interest on board. If you want to maintain support for climate policy, you're going to have. So I will touch also on the other theme and on the electric vehicles. You're going to have the coalition include the unions and the industry, and they're going to want that everybody has to pay. So to this idea that could we tweak it, like Catherine said, and let them have a price of 25, if you want these laws to pass, you're going to have to get
the people who want the level playing field. So that's part of the problem. With the taxes, with the tariffs, it's a bit the same thing. So that was to your point about tweaking. And to the tariffs, it's a bit the same thing. You want as a social planner, as the president of the world, in your analogy that people have been saying, like, oh, it's great. We have a way to decarbonize. All our cars are going to be electrical in 5 years, and we just let all these Chinese cars flow into Europe. True. But who's going to govern in 5 years? I mean, are these going to be pro-climate people, or are we going to have a huge backlash and populist parties in power and the whole thing is lost? So I think the Commission there is trying to maintain a very difficult equilibrium. The thing that's going to make it politically very hard is that the Chinese have decided to invest in car plants in Europe, particularly in Hungary and in other places, and they're going to be trying to get to break the coalition in Europe to say, well, certain countries are going to be kind of the aircraft carriers for China in Europe, Hungary in particular. So I think this is a very, very fine line that you want to try to use, and that's why I was trying to draw it on, yes, to electric to solar panels. They're very cheap. Let's use them. And we cannot produce them. We've been trying for 10 years, and we can't do it in Europe at a good price. And for electric vehicles, I mean, even as an economist who totally believes in trade, in free trade, I mean, I think if we let the car industry, which is 11% of GDP, 10% of GDP in countries like France, Italy, Spain, Germany, I mean, if you with supplies and with all the rest, if you let that die, I mean, you've seen what happened in the last 2 days. Sweden has one of the big Swedish plants is in trouble, the ones who were biggest producer of batteries, because Volkswagen has reduced the number of cars with electric cars they're doing. So, I mean, the European firms are just not able yet.
Okay. Let's take a few more questions. Let's go up to the balcony. I think there's a woman there in the black top who's very patient.
Yes, thank you. My name is Miala. I actually have two really quick questions. My first question is
just one, I'm afraid.
Shoot. Just one? Okay, then I'll make sure. Regarding the US. So while the Inflation Reduction Act sounds great, under the Democratic government, oil extraction has been the highest ever. Do you think that's going to change under a potential Harris government?
Okay. Gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Antonius, PhD from UCL. I'm from Indonesia. So my question is about, I think the CBAM is like a kind of a philosophy of sticks. And I thought about the carrots for the developing countries to really speed up the decarbonization process. Like, I thought about how, is it politically feasible to like democratize the green technologies such as the wind turbine or fission nuclear technology, so the capex in the developing countries can decrease and we can speed up the decarbonization effort, because yeah, we love to do that, but yeah, the cost is high. Thank you.
Okay. Lady there.
Thank you. I will be quick. I have a specific question regarding the application of ETS and CBAM to agricultural products.
Could you? I can't hear that.
Yeah. Have a specific question regarding the application of ETS and CBAM to agricultural products, whether this mechanism could be expanded to agricultural sector to decarbonize. Thank you.
Okay, so there's a lot of technical CBAM questions. Luis, or who wants to try and...
On the agriculture, you saw what happened to Macron when he tried to put the diesel. It wasn't even like agricultural products. I mean, the problem with farming, you know that Catherine and me have been working, Catherine, much more on thinking about methane. Methane comes from agriculture, and there is a lot of global warming that comes from methane. A lot of it comes from China. And if you wanted to touch that, I mean, you will have a lot of trouble with farmers. It's really, I mean, agricultural products are really, really, really politically very, very different, very complicated. Right now, the approach is like, okay, we look somewhere else, okay? And nobody wants to really get anywhere near that. So I'm sorry about that. And about the carrots, I guess I'm being dismal in the two questions. But about the carrots, yes, we should help the developing countries. Egypt, for example, is going to be one of the countries that is going to be vulnerable to CBAM. It would be fantastic to have the budgetary space to do that. But I mean, Europe just feels like, I mean, there is this moment where there is no money for anything, and the UK is kind of feeling similarly, I think. So it's, I'm sorry, but it's sticks and not carrots, both for the rest of the world and for us as well.
And Catherine, the IRA, what's its future after November?
I heard the question about the oil prices too, so let me answer that. Well, actually, I'd love to say something about a couple of the questions. So I guess in U.S. politics, gasoline prices are like kryptonite. I mean, they are just so, politics are so sensitive to gasoline prices. So yes, oil extraction went up under Biden. I don't actually think that's so bad from a climate perspective, because if it hadn't been us, it would have been Saudi Arabia or it would have been Russia increasing their oil production. The world is still consuming oil, so the U.S. itself producing oil, it'll make oil prices a little bit higher, but not enough higher. I think that was more kind of a political decision, because if gas prices were high, we would have a Trump administration for sure. And geopolitical, like the fact that the U.S. is producing gives Russia less power and takes some money away from them to fight their war in Ukraine. So I don't mean, this might be contradictory to my answer to the question about the protesters, but I don't know, like, lay off on Harris a little bit on this one. That would be my, like, let her get elected and then...
Then protest.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead. Okay. Your thing, or... Let's get some questions from the online audience. Ram, I think you've been collecting a few of the online questions, so you've got to give us a few of them, and I'll let us the first ones.
Yeah, I'll give you a couple online questions. We have one from Radhika Sanyal, who asks, CBAM is encouraging exporting countries to implement carbon pricing and apply that before exporting to the EU. Could this generate inflation? And if so, could this generate inflation? And if so, is the EU ready to pay for the green for this? We have another one from Oyn Tucker, who asks, has there been
inflation? It could generate inflation. If so, is the EU ready to
pay the price for it?
Yeah.
We have one from Oyn Tucker, who asks, has there been any retaliatory action to CBAM so far? And do you see this being an issue in the future?
Retaliatory action.
That's it? Okay. We're back on CBAM. Everybody loves CBAM.
Yeah.
So on inflation, I mean, I wouldn't say inflation, not the sustaining kind of rate of price shock. I mean, to some extent, I guess it could I don't know. There could be some, but I mean, already the countries in Europe are paying that price through the ETS. Yes, I guess we're ready for that. As to the retaliatory moves, it hasn't. You know what I showed you in the first slide is that basically is that we are not doing anything right now. So what you need to do is to send some paperwork and show that you are complying with paperwork. You don't need to pay anything. So until two more years, people are going to be like shadow boxing and thinking about it. It's not going to be like on. And so it's not really the moment where the retaliation or the dispute is happening. So I hope there won't be, and I hope that very conciliatory view of Minister Rojas, which is like, yes, we want to decarbonize, and we all think it's a global responsibility, will be the one that will prevail, but we'll see.
So let's take a last round of questions.
Amir Lavdioui from the University of Oxford. Allow me to tell you a short joke that is not very funny. Imagine a European, a Latin American, an African boarding a plane, right? There's no fee on baggage. The European brings 200 kilos of suitcases. After the first 100 kilos checked in, the pilot says, look, plane is getting really heavy. We're going to have to start imposing a penalty, right, on extra luggage. Sounds fair, but now, from now on, every single added kilo, right, has a price, has a penalty. No one has an allowance anymore. So, of course, the African, Latin American complain, but then you tell them, look, it's good for everyone, and you travel lighter, right? So let's just do it. And would you think that this is good policy? And specifically, the challenge... The problem is not...
I think we got it. Yeah.
It's
accumulated CO2, that's right. Yeah. That's
okay. Very good question. Excellent question. History of stock. Chat behind you.
Hello, I'm Salvatore, MSc Economic History, LSC. My question is, given the influence that China has had in Africa, I mean, we had BRICS Plus, which is emerging. We have the Global South, which is grouping up together. Would you say that a CBAM can be harmful for European countries? Let's just say I'm Mozambique.
So, which countries?
European countries. Let's just say I'm Mozambique, and I say, okay, I need to pay to export my goods to Europe. However, I will not pay anything if I export my goods to China, to Russia. So the same applies for southern American countries, which have strong ties with Russia as well. So thank you.
Okay, thanks. And any last questions? Okay, chat just behind you.
If you were a Mozambican producer of alumina and you've arranged offset projects, so for example reforestation, so you can claim your production is net zero CO2 emissions, would you have to pay a CBAM tax?
Oh, very specific question. Okay, so I think what max 1 minute from each.
Yeah, again, I'm going to talk about the fair share of the remaining carbon budget, basically, right? I understand the logic, and I think this has been a very important principle of all climate action, right? Is that we have common responsibilities, common but differentiated responsibilities. The problem is that at this point of time, the carbon budget is small, and we will all have to reduce. And that is the principle also of the Paris Agreement, that every country, big or small, puts their part on the table. But it has to be fair. And that means that if you had a very small historical contribution, then you should be helped to do your contribution with help from the other countries. But the truth is as well that by now the G20 has 80% of the GDP, 80% of the emissions, and they really have to do their part. Now, in the case of Chile, which has a very small amount of current emission, I mean, don't talk even about accumulated emissions, it's tiny. But as I mentioned with some of the examples I said, the benefit of decarbonization are important. They're important for health, they're important for the environment, for local environment as well, they're important for poverty. So I see that path of development, a green development, is a good development, and it will make me also more resilient. And I guess that's the position of Chile, and that we do want to wake to pay our share because it's good for us as well.
Catherine?
Lots of great questions. I guess I'll take the accumulated CO2 one as well and say a bit about the fragmented global trading structure. The one thing that struck me recently is a graph I saw that plotted the share of the, like, across the world differences in carbon prices, the share of that is between country versus within country. And it used to be, like 1990, you know, not even that long ago, that most of the difference was between country. Now, most of the difference is actually within country. So the, like, rich people everywhere are the ones that are generating the CO2 emissions. So in some ways, I think this kind of, like, our country versus your country framing might not be the right framing anymore. Like, I looked this up recently. 95% of the world population has never been on an airplane. The people that are making the decisions and having the conversations are mostly from the global elite, and we're not representative of, like, a lot of the rest of the world in our own countries as well as in other countries. So I think that's important to keep in mind as well. I do worry about the fragmentation. There are lots of pushes towards protectionism, and so I think yes, especially, for instance, if President Trump gets reelected, that's a real potential outcome. He's threatening huge tariffs on lots of imports. So I hope we don't end up there, and I hope that we come to some agreement around CBAM. And I guess the best CBAM is a CBAM that's never enforced because lots of countries adopt carbon pricing. So hopefully we end up there and not in a very fragmented... Trade's good, so hopefully we continue to trade.
Great. Louise?
I think that's fine. I mean, I just on the carbon offsets, I'm not a big fan, and many people in this world is not a big fan. It wouldn't be possible. And part of the offset programs, for example, in Africa, there was a very long expose. I think it was in the Financial Times or in Bloomberg. Somebody kind of claims the credits because they were going to cut some trees and they haven't cut the trees. So you just have to go around looking for trees that weren't cut. So you just point to the trees and you say, look, these trees are still here. So this is an offset. And it's kind of, you get into a very kind of vague area and it's very, very hard to enforce. So I think that what we have here is the
Okay, well, thank you to all our panelists. Last round of applause. And it's been a great pleasure for me, and I think hopefully for you as well, for the evening discussion. And thank you in the audience and the online audience for listening, and hope to see you back at LSE again very soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.